I met a couple of MIT professors, one of which, I remember I sat down with him the first time at the Marriott in Kendall Square, and he looks at me and he's like, Yuri, I see that you're doing something interesting. And he writes down blockchain on a piece of paper and hands it over to me. And he's like, this is the future. This is what you need to get your students involved in. And I was like, I don't know what this is.
Welcome to Boston Blockchain, where we focus on the people and projects that are driving innovation in the industry. I'm Kyle Hedman of China Shop Productions, and today's guest is Yuri Cataldo, co-founder of Athenian Capital. In this episode, Yuri explains how a bottled water project led to recognizing the power of Bitcoin, why creators should be embracing AI tools, and his real motivation for writing the book, Be Left Behind. The link for that will be in the show notes, but now let's meet Yuri.
All right, Yuri, thanks so much for taking the time to come down here. You're the last one of a busy schedule, so I'll try to maintain the energy and enthusiasm.
Oh, excellent, excellent. Well, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it, and I apologize for being a few minutes late.
Oh, no. Actually, that worked out perfectly. We had a little bit of a snafu with some of the addresses that went out. I think we accidentally directed people to building like two blocks down.
So. Oh, that's okay. I'm not used to coming to Quincy either. This is great. I actually got to explore the city by looking for a parking spot. So
the city is amazing. Like when, just walking down the little like city hall area, there's so much cool stuff over there.
Yeah, it reminds me that I just need to like post this and post the conference to stick around. And like, I've heard there's some phenomenal restaurants here.
Yes. Have you been to the Fours yet?
No, I haven't.
That's just right down the street or okay. Right across from the event. You have the best clam chowder I've ever had. You will not be able to eat clam chowder anywhere else after that.
I love it. I mean, that's already high praise.
I see you got an MIT shirt on.
I do.
Did you graduate from there?
I did. I graduated in 2023 from their MBA program.
Okay. I was in the Navy nuclear power program, and the MIT people actually wrote our curriculum for that.
Oh, excellent. It's actually, how'd that go? Did that work okay?
it was billed as one of the hardest programs in the country. It was like top three, like just below like Harvard Law and like something else at the time. Okay. Like, I had like a 66% attrition rate. By the time I went through, it was like maybe 5%. And really, you had to really do something stupid to get kicked out of there, like a DUI or just not. Try.
Yeah.
Like it really has turned more into like a pump system as opposed to like a filter. But
no,
it was definitely difficult. It was very comprehensive. Mm-hmm. It was like a 4-year program condensed into like a 9-month period. Or 18 months. I'm sorry.
That sounds super intense.
Yeah. It was like basically 7 to 4 every day. And if you were not doing well, then you got assigned study hours. And that would range from 10 hours a week to 50 if you were really bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. So some people were there till like 11 o'clock every night and then spending 12 hours on the weekend.
Oh, all doing this. Oh, wow. Yes. Oh, wow. And what did that program ultimately at the end, what did you end up doing post-program?
When I got out of that, I was assigned to a submarine and ran the electrical plant as an electrician.
Yeah.
Also the shutdown reactor operations too. I wasn't the reactor operator under power, but when they were in port and shut down, then they trusted me enough to sit in front of the panel and make sure it didn't start up on its own.
Oh, that's great. How long did you do that for?
I was in the Navy for about 6 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was basically my way of getting an education, so I actually have MIT to thank for that.
Yeah.
They really set me up for success down the road.
Oh, well, that's awesome. That's awesome. It's good to hear that. Like, well, it's... So... Coming from institutions like this, it's very easy to like, you know, pat ourselves on the back on part of that. But it's great to actually hear that these universities are doing good outside of just the, you know, the four walls and their institutions.
And the people who can afford to pay the crazy prices.
Yes.
Like I didn't have to pay anything. They paid me.
Yeah.
Like,
oh, that's thank awesome. You. That's even better. I wish that would have worked out on my side. I am fortunate that because my day job was with a large corporation, they helped cover some of those costs. So, but like it is hugely prohibitive to go to some of these institutions just because of the rising costs.
Right.
Undergrad, I'm from Indiana originally. I went to Indiana University. Actually, I went to Purdue first and then Indiana University for free. So advantage of being in state, going to like having great institutions, public institutions that just made it possible so that I could go to grad school at some more expensive institutions.
Right.
But I couldn't even imagine.
Can you imagine doing 4 years there? Oh my gosh.
a few years ago, I was a professor at Emerson College and just like chatting with some of the students of just like, I don't know what it is now, but I think then it was like $60,000 a semester or a year.
Oh my gosh.
Like leaving your undergrad in just, you know, So whatever Emerson does aside, I won't like pick on them, but because I also was their creative entrepreneurship professor, but just like getting a degree in the arts and then having come out of that, spending $200,000 for a degree in the arts, like statistically speaking, you're not gonna like catch up faster than somebody who went to school for computer science or something. And so it's just like some of these institutions are doing a huge disservice to their students by sticking them with these huge tuition costs because of then what the possibility is post education. But it's great to hear that at least in your instance, though, that like...
Right. I don't want to spend too much time dissecting the public school systems and the college systems, but...
I mean, that's okay. That's fun, too.
Well, let's talk about how you got kind of into the crypto and blockchain space in general, then. Like, mm-hmm. how did your interest in the spaces get sparked?
Yeah, sure. It actually coincides with my time in Emerson. Mm-hmm. So before that... So my background's in the arts. I'll do the quick version of what got me interested in crypto, but... My background is in theater. And so growing up, I'm from an industrial part of Indiana, Elkhart, okay. Indiana, actually. So the RV capital of the world. I went to really not a good public school and through there got involved in design for manufacturing.
Okay.
And so I worked for, I actually helped design the first minivan taxi cabs. And because I worked for this company that would convert minivans for mm-hmm. handy capable purposes. And then they got a contract, and this was like late 90s, that Chicago and New York wanted to expand their taxi fleet. And so I'm like this, you know, fresh-faced graduate, high school, soon to be high school graduate. And they're like, well, you know CAD and you know, like work with our fabricators, come up with this. And so that was like the original spark that got me into design.
Right.
I thought I wanted to become actually I didn't know what it was called. I thought that was mechanical engineering, and so that's what I got into at Purdue. That's not at all. Mechanical engineering is totally different. And so I learned that the hard way, because Purdue is a phenomenal institution, and I was very fortunate to go there for free, and I got into their mechanical engineering program, but I dropped out after a year and a half.
What were you expecting it to be like?
more on the design stuff. And okay. for some reason right now, like the actual term, industrial design. So... I had never heard the term industrial design. No one, like at my high school or even when I would describe what I wanted to do, everybody was like, oh yeah, mechanical engineering. And so what I really wanted to become was industrial designer. I just didn't know the term. So never came across that idea until like years later. And so went in for mechanical engineering thinking it was more about like redesigning structures right. like I was doing in high school or for this company. Not at all. A lot of math, which is now funny.
Safety factors.
Exactly.
Safety
like what I do now, it's hilarious. But so I was like, great. I want to do design, no math. I dropped out, did some volunteer work. Then I transferred to IU in Bloomington and got involved in the theater.
In
program.
Illinois?
I'm sorry?
Bloomington, Illinois?
Yes, Indiana. Bloomington, okay, Indiana. Okay. It's Indiana University. And I took a lot of different classes to kind of explore. And again, that's... And now we're going to stick on education for a little bit. But like the benefits of going to a liberal arts state school is that you're encouraged to take a lot of different, it'll come back around at the end, a lot of different aspects of like what a rounded education really means. And so I was taking like, you know, from the finance department, from these phenomenal painting, drawing instructors, from like physics, from the actual people who do instruct that. But because of the options available at IU Bloomington, I was able to try different interests while I was trying to figure out as a 19-year-old what I want to do with my life based off of what I had before.
Right, because what 19-year-old actually knows what they want to do? And the ones that do, you know, screw you.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, those are like super, super focused. And so even then, so I come from an even weirder background. And so I grew up as a Jehovah's Witness. And so education was highly frowned upon. And so in order to actually go to college, I became less of a, actually I left the church that way. But like a lot of my friends I grew up with, they're still doing what they're doing and they're having a great time and that's great for them. But it was like this weird thing of like, you can either be involved in the religion or you can study, you can do higher education, but you can't do both.
Right.
And so that was kind of like a split where I was just like on my own at 19, 20, figuring out like my past life, I couldn't do that anymore. and that I didn't agree with me anymore. So what do I do? And so, again, going to this large institution allowed me to like test out a lot of different things and meet new people that I never would have otherwise, because large institutions like this bring together right. people from around the world. Like, and Indiana University is a phenomenal school like that, that attracts talent. And so it was like getting just new experiences that open your eyes up to different parts of the world that, particularly in the late 90s in Indiana, you know, AOL, broadband kind of stuff. It's not like I'm, you know, really exploring the world like you can a little bit more today.
Right. But when we were kids, it was a little harder to meet people outside of your neighborhood.
Yes. Yeah. Or let alone other parts of the world. So Bloomington was great. Took a lot of different classes, landed on. So I love design. I actually learned a lot of the like design and building things. That actually comes from my grandfather. My grandfather is and grandmother came over during World War II. My grandfather is Ukrainian. My grandmother's Russian. They came over during World War II as refugees to Indiana. He ended up designing and building furniture for RVs. And so a lot growing up, I spent a lot of time working with him on like fabric choices, design of furniture. Again, this is like early CAD stuff. He would do everything by hand. And a lot of what he was hired to do was like custom made things. And so spending time with him helped me kind of think through like structurally, how do you think through a larger problem? His instance was like the problem was furniture, but like, how do you think about problems and like design so that people actually want to use this?
Yeah.
And then make choices, whether again, it's like the materials you use or how you build it to make it better for the individual.
Almost like he taught you how to put yourself in a different mindset when you're approaching a problem.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And his is very human centered. Which again comes back around later, but it's like the human side approach of design, which is all throughout a lot of the arts. But it's like, you know, how do you get yourself out of your own head to think about the end user versus like how you would do it? But if you're doing it for yourself, then like what's right. the point?
Well, you promised to tie that around. So
yeah, exactly.
We'll start working on connecting the ends here.
Yeah, so we will. So like the fast forward then is, so I was in theater. I used to work on Broadway in my late 20s. Then the financial collapse happens. I go back to Indiana to kind of restart my career. And at that same time, I got involved in some startups. So I hit my own startups. I actually launched a bottled water company that went on to win many international awards.
What was the name of that? I remember here.
Indigo H2O.
Thank you. Yes.
The website still exists. I don't sell water anymore. But through that, I came across actually Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. The first time, this was like 2012, I think 2013.
Pretty
and
early, yeah.
I was, at the end of this, the product was good. I became an exceptional marketer. The product, like direct-to-consumer water company thing was still kind of off and taking. But so I was trying multiple different types of like marketing publicity stunts. And one of them was like accepting Bitcoin. So
yeah.
My water company, I've got a press release about this, first bottled water company in the world to accept Bitcoin. I received zero sales from it. I got a couple features, which is what the goal was, but right. like nobody, you know, my prime demographic of buyers didn't really care about Bitcoin. And so it was like, I thought maybe I could get like a new, like, oh, this would be great. I get a new demographic of people who want to buy overpriced water, which is what I was selling. It was very nice, but like, I mean, it is what it is. So it didn't happen at all. So then I was like, okay, I didn't understand what Bitcoin was, but I knew it was powerful enough to get publicity for it.
Right.
So then fast forward 2015, professor at Emerson College, I was hired because of my background in the arts as well as my entrepreneurship experience. And I built their creative entrepreneurship program. Through that, I wanted to get my students out of the building because, again, students who just like, especially art students who are just insular to themselves will, you know, they won't really get a full experience, a full educational experience as I want them to get.
Yes.
So I went to a lot of different events. I met a couple of MIT professors, one of which, I remember I sat down with him the first time at the Marriott in Kendall Square, and he looks at me and he's like, Yuri, I see that you're doing something interesting. And he writes down blockchain on a piece of paper and hands it over to me. And he's like, this is the future. This is what you need to get your students involved in. And I was like, I don't know what this is. But you're from MIT. I trust you. And so, great. Now I need to figure out what this is. And then a month later, I went to a conference. It was an independent conference. And the keynote speaker, which I didn't, so I didn't know this was happening. It just coincided at this conference because it was like, I think the conference wasn't more about like finance. Mm-hmm. So the one of the keynote speakers comes out. I believe his name was Ned. He ran Steemit. And he, for the first time, explained to me what blockchain tokens were, like the concept of what it is, and how now individuals, not sovereign nations, can create a form of currency that others can derive value from. And so that was my first introduction to all this, was like through Steemit. Absolutely fascinated. I jumped in with some of the friends I met there, and we were like trying Steemit accounts, and like that's where my first few bucks in like Bitcoin came, because then I had to teach myself. Okay, I
that have was this. Back in the days when you had to have your own wallet.
And yes, like, yes, yeah. It was, and I had to like watch YouTube videos and right. read lots and lots and lots of documents of like how does it even work, because a lot of very smart nerds were doing all this, and I was neither of those. Mm-hmm. And so I had to like teach myself and learn from others. And so it was really exciting in 2015 to just like figure out like, you know, if I buy this, how do I buy it? How do I store it? How do I keep it? And I met a lot of individuals who were working in different projects. And I also started getting involved in projects at that time too.
But you're not just involved in blockchain, but you also seem to have some experience with AI. I'm looking at like the topics that you got planned for today.
I do now.
Yeah. Okay. Is that kind of the same thing? Someone got you...
Yes. So one of the things I learned from my days as a designer was that you can never do just one thing. So as like a professional set and costume designer, which is what I was for a little bit, there's never one job that pays for everything. And so you're always looking at like the next two or three jobs, and sometimes you're juggling them simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And so it's just ingrained in me from my early 20s to do multiple things simultaneously so that you can plan for the future.
Yeah.
My interest in blockchain and AI has like been overlapping at the same time I'm doing like a day job or a couple other things. And so the AI part of it came in the last like 3 or 4 years during the pandemic. I work for, my day job is with a large tech company, and I'm on their research team. And it just worked out that we also started to get very heavily invested in AI, and I was at the right place, the right time. And so I was able to help stand up a couple of projects and programs and then learn while doing it, while I'm working with individuals who have PhDs and in these different areas. And then that led me to MIT. And so like, you can't go to MIT and not learn about AI. I think it's a part of the charter.
So this is a little bit off the topic of blockchain technology, but I think AI is close enough adjacent that we can explore that a little bit. With the advances that AI has been making in the creative spaces, which blows my mind that that would be the spot that, you know, they would see that sort of growth that quickly. Things like Udio.com, like we've written, like you just type in a couple prompts and it spits out a song. And some of these songs are better than stuff you're hearing on the radio. Like if you're a creator, like, are you getting scared about your future?
Yeah, that's a great question. I was able to give a lecture at Juilliard a couple of months ago on this very topic, and it's absolutely fascinating to just.
Is that online anywhere?
Unfortunately, it's not. But every year, Juilliard does a entrepreneurship. It's an entrepreneurship conference, and I know they expanded beyond. So I went to Juilliard for a year, was part of a specialized program, and so they considered me to be alumni, even though I didn't actually study from there, and so they invite a lot of alumni to come back and give talks. I was the weird one who was like, hey, I want to talk about AI. Everyone else is talking about like piano, like composition, and I'm the person talking about AI. I had a great, like it was a great panel that I was on, and then gave a talk afterward and had a lot of questions just about this kind of thing. So a lot of artists, if you look at it on the surface, it can be absolutely terrifying. And then you're right. Now there's like, so like ChatGPT can write a book. There's a lot of other programs that can write a song. How I look at this and how I've been talking to different artists about this is like, you have to think of AI as more like your assistant. Yes, ChatGPT can write a book. If you actually look at the book, it's going to be garbage.
Yes.
Because there's no context. There's no, like, you know, we can get into like, there's no soul of it. But really there are certain elements that humans, we interject into our speech and language that computers cannot understand yet, because computers are just mimicking what we're doing. They're not creating this from scratch. computers are phenomenal at seeing patterns. They just see patterns and they're like, now we can mimic this. That's why one of my favorite TikTok channels is like someone's creating a new country song every single day using AI. And they're hilarious. Right. It's like, I think one was like, it's beers and can I swear on this podcast?
If okay. you want
it's
to,
like man. Beers and butts and like we got a whole lot of beers and guns and butts. Cause it's when you look at country music that's popular and you like analyze the words they use, there's a lot of people talking about beers and trucks. That's it, trucks and guns and butts and beers and like
it
repeats it over and over again. And it's hilarious. So but obviously you're like, that's not real, but that's what country music sounds like if you look at it from one particular area.
So the difference in then is it's never going to create something new. It's always going to be referencing something that has been done.
Yes.
So that's you're a, never going to get
that's a great way to put
new
it.
Content out of them.
Yes. Right now, anyway, yes. Like, you know, there's a lot of speculation of what could happen.
Mm-hmm.
Those are people, you know, smarter than I am who look at that. I'm just like looking at the reality of this, particularly because I work with a lot of AI researchers who are looking at the now. And yes, AI can only mimic. AI cannot create something new. It's not going to create the next Mozart type of music from scratch because it doesn't have, you know, for lack of a better word, a soul.
Right.
To really think logically and do that. It can only mirror and find patterns and create that kind of stuff. So that's why when I was chatting with these different musicians, I'm encouraging them to utilize AI
right.
to help them. What AI is phenomenal with, and I do this all the time, like it's the, you know, the terror of the white blank
yes,
page.
Yes, getting started.
Yes.
Yes.
And so it's great of like creating an outline, creating you like going back and forth of like testing out different ideas.
How do I start this email with this person that I've never met?
It's, yeah. Or even like some nuances. I mean, right. I use it now to correct my grammar. My grammar is absolutely terrible. But I'm like, is this the best way to write this sentence? And it'll say, no, you should do this and this and this. But it's like, it's there to augment what you're doing, not replace you.
I don't know if I've told John this, and I'm not sure if he's listening. we actually used ChatGPT to write the quote for this job because we had no idea.
I love it. I love it. I mean, also so that for my... That talk I gave at Juilliard, I used ChatGPT to help me write the like the pitch to them because I was like, here's the audience, here's what I think they're interested in, like help me kind of like curate it to them, and then I go in and fix it. But it's like it's there to augment you. Now the thing that I did remind them of, like, so is AI going to steal your job right now? No, but you know who will steal your job? Somebody's like with your talents who understands AI. That individual is going to take your job
yes.
because they can do it faster and they understand what's happening in technology and they will use that to their advantage. So there is only an advantage of like if we're talking about artists, like artists utilizing, if not at least understanding what's happening, because everybody's using AI in one way or another. Like,
yes.
Yeah. When I was in grad school, so it was like 2022, my first year of grad school, ChatGPT 3.5 suddenly or 3 came out. And there were a lot of conversations at MIT of, well, now all of these students are utilizing ChatGPT. What do we do about this? Because it came out in, I remember it was like November. And suddenly one of my classmates was like, hey, Yuri, check this out. You need to go try this thing. And what it did a great job of, it was actually, I was in my finance class, of reteaching kind of the finance parts to me.
Yeah, yeah.
But I guarantee you, starting in January, every single one of my classmates and I started using it to like, draft out our first drafts of our papers.
First draft is the key there.
It was the first draft, and professors had no idea what to do because suddenly all of these students were just turning in, whether again some people edited it more than others, but like it was happening on campus live, and they had no idea what to do, and it was freaking everybody out.
Let's not just point the finger at the students though, because I saw plenty of instances yes. of teachers using ChatGPT to grade essays. And
yes. There's definitely that too. I just say that because I'm like absolute personal experience. Because then also some of my classmates were like the heads of other programs. So I went through the executive MBA program. So some of them were also professors of other institutions, and it was like hearing just how many professors were just freaking out. Because they didn't know what to do. There were no grading criteria. There was like suddenly in the syllabus following the year after was, okay, so you can use ChatGPT, but you have to quote it. And we're also going to run, like there was just like new policies that just came out overnight because of the advent of AI. And that's not going to stop. It's only going to increase in every single industry. And so if you're not with the times, someone's going to then use AI to their advantage and like go around.
Look at calculators and math and like the way that has changed over the years. Like when my dad was a kid, like a calculator was not allowed in the classroom. Even when I was a kid, like having a calculator to do math was frowned upon. They wanted to show your work to prove that you knew how to do it. But let's be honest, none of us are not going to use a calculator. Like, we need to know how to use this tool.
Yes. Yes, precisely. And now it's like even faster, because now ChatGPT is integrated within a few other sites that can do advanced math for you. And so you don't actually have to learn how to do that. What's really important with education, especially early days, is like teaching you how to think and to reason and to question.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're seeing this right now with an election of like a lot of people questioning what is reality and just accepting, you know, whatever the side, it doesn't matter. There are things that get put out that people are just believe it as absolute fact. And they don't question things and like reason and think through of like, okay, if this is true, there are multiple steps you have to go backwards to start from to make this true. And so that's actually like the educational system, and it's also why I like arts education, is very good at making people have stronger critical thinking skills, because you can't just take something at its face value. You have to like think through the other stuff of like, you know, at a certain point, unless you're a mathematician, you don't really have to know advanced calculus, unless that's your job. Like,
right.
I really want all my engineers, particularly the ones at Boeing or Airbus, to know their math down. And so they don't have to, you know, use ChatGPT to cheat. But like the average person, I don't care. Cheat using ChatGPT to do your math. That doesn't matter.
It only makes you better.
Exactly. Yeah. It makes you better. And it will also allow you to understand faster when people bring up things, because you can then search for information at a faster rate that will then help you kind of understand what actually is happening. And then you can ask important questions and get to the heart of whether or not this is true or not.
The other thing that's not really mentioned enough, but it's actually a great learning tool too. I learned so much about programming Python by using ChatGPT when I had zero knowledge of the language to start with. But now I've been able to use it to write like my own custom studies for, you know, trading programs and other stuff like that. Like, it's really kind of cool. Do you see AI and blockchain intermingling or complementing each other? And what does that look like?
So I recently joined the board of a company who's doing drug discovery. So it's a CRO, drug rediscovery. Actually, now they've realized it's kind of their forte.
What does that mean? Like going back at past things that have been done and finding new applications for them?
Yes.
Awesome.
And so I have like kind of been, again, and I do the same thing. This is also what my weird curiosity kind of leads me down things.
Right.
Technically, I have no background in healthcare. I have no business really joining all this, except I have a lot of contacts in the venture capital and researcher space.
And it's interesting.
And it's interesting. And so I oftentimes chase my own curiosities. And what I've really come to find out more about is like how clinical trials are done. Clinical trials really come from, lack of a better word, like institutions with a lot of money. So whether that's like, you know, a university setting or a pharmaceutical company, you have to have a lot of money to bring drugs to market. It's crazy expensive to go to the clinical trials. Clinical trials also, because it's so expensive, once you get there, the people who run them start handpicking individuals that will benefit them the most, which is like, you know, everybody wants to do that the most. What happens is then in some of these trials, people are then looked at as a statistic versus like if this is actually going to work. So statistically, you are better off for my trial, so let's run that. What's happening, there's one program particularly doing this, and the name of it will come to me while I'm talking. But when you hear about like what's happening in AI and blockchain, a lot of people think that it's like a panacea, that like you can just throw this at an existing thing and then it will solve it. And that's not really how it works. You have to actually have a problem first you're trying to solve. And there are elements that like blockchain and AI are good at. So thinking them more as like a how versus a what.
Mm-hmm.
There's a company in particular that's doing personalized medicine and helping expand the pool of clinical trials right now in a safe way. And so it's using the elements of blockchain that people have been just, you know, talking about since the early days. Or even like when Ethereum came out in 2015, about how it's the computer side of blockchain, how you own your data. You don't allow, like in the Web 2 world, where like, again, the Metas and Amazons of the world and Google mine you for profit. this company allows for clinical trials for everybody in the world to opt in. And so they use the best parts of blockchain in that there's transparency, there's privacy, but you get to find out what clinical trials are happening. So you're not a statistic, you're not someone's guinea pig, and you get to decide which ones you want to join. And it's helping to expand the idea of personalized medicine. Because the other side of, like, when we start redeveloping some of these drugs is, so yes, it didn't work for the statistical part of the population over here. But with gene therapies and everything else now, we can narrow down and dig into specifically types of drugs that will work with your type of body. And this company particularly, and the company I work for, are in the cancer research. So, like, think about this, like, specialized cancer medicine that's now honed in to you versus, like, the statistical parts of the United States.
AI is probably the thing that you're going through and looking to see where the statistical anomalies are, where the common factors between the people that maybe the drug was successful in, and then seeing if there's ways that you can amplify that by selection criteria.
And it's also, so it does that as well. It also helps speed up the redevelopment process. Mm-hmm. And the other part that this company is doing is that the AI actually explains to the individual user what their rights are, how their data will be used. And this is something that, again, like, no pharmaceutical company or even like an institutional researcher is going to explain to somebody.
Right.
Like, how your data will be used, that we will not mine your data for this. And so they're using AI agents to explain to the person in terms, in language that they understand, what their rights are as an individual, as a human, like what their data will be used for, what they should opt in for or not opt in for. And so it's like, it's building from the ground up a new type of way that individuals can plug in to clinical trials, rather than like someone taking an existing Web 2 solution, like trying to jam blockchain on it, which we have seen across the board doesn't really work. You have to like start from scratch. And so absolutely great. As we're talking, I'm going to look up this company because I feel like I'm just going to like speak to them in the abstract.
I was going to link them if we couldn't find it.
Here we go. Solve.care. I'm not affiliated with them in any kind of way. I just recently heard about what they're working on, and it sounds phenomenal. Because it's this kind of, like, when I first was introduced to blockchain in 2015, this was the type of company, this is the type of situation, solutions that I wanted to be a part of. And it's been a little bit disheartening over the last, let's say, 9 years, watching, like, a lot of the same questions that were being asked in 2015 are still being asked, like, what's the potential? I'm interested in what's actually being built right now.
Yes, okay.
And unfortunately, like, you know, the FTXs of the world really messed things up.
I know.
And have derailed. But it's great to hear, like, these one-off companies who are taking what blockchain is really used for and building that up and then making this decentralized system that's anonymized, that is, like, the user first. And so I think more and more and more of these will start coming up because people are starting to understand a little bit more of, like, you can't just take Web 2, smash into Web 3, and then call it whatever that is. That's how we get FTX.
Yeah.
But you build something from ground up that really is the users buying in and opting in.
Okay, so we're almost at the half-hour mark now, which was our normal scheduled time. But I wanted to give you a chance to talk about something that you're working on before we turn the mics off. So I see had a book that just came out not too long ago.
About 2020.
2020?
Okay, yeah.
4 years.
We can talk about the book.
It's less than 10% of my life.
Yeah. Although it's funny, 2020 feels like both 10 years ago and yesterday.
I know, it's so weird, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
So the book is called... it's a cheeky title.
Be Left Behind.
Be Left Behind, Discover Blockchain and Bitcoin Before Your Grandmother Beats You to It. So the basis of the book. So a lot of the individuals that I met in that conference in 2015 became close friends. And we tried to launch a couple of projects in 2016. Didn't work out. We actually were trying to build like an e-trade for crypto in 2016. Mm-hmm. Our code got stolen, like everything that could have gone wrong went wrong. I had never been part of a real tech company before. That was like my first foray in there. And I was like, oh my God, everything is crashing. This is terrible. But from there, I was the chief marketing officer. And so I was like, you know, the problem that's happening right now, and it's through my own experience, is that in order to understand how to even trade or buy Bitcoin, I have to watch a dozen YouTube channels or read articles that are written by very smart computer scientists who don't know how to dumb things down for the average person.
Right.
And so we started a podcast from that where we would reach out to all these great projects that are popping up and make them explain what they're doing to the average person. From that, I learned a ton about blockchain, what was happening, what's possible, what's not possible. And then from that podcast, we turned it into a book. So I co-wrote it with his name is Steve Good. He's actually a CEO now of his own blockchain startup called DreamsQuest. It's a gaming company. That's doing a phenomenal job. They're also kind of building up a media entertainment company with that at the same time. But they're doing a phenomenal job of that. And so this book was essentially written for my mother. My mom, you know, who's in her 70s now, was like, I don't understand what you're doing. And so I didn't have at that time, there are some other books now, but like at that time, there wasn't a book I could give her that explained to it, explained what blockchain was or the possibility of the future in terminology she would understand. And so that's what that was. We spent months like working with our publishers and editors of like writing and rewriting and rewriting. And so the content now, while it was published in 2020, is more evergreen content. There are some specific references to projects that were popular in 2020 that I think don't exist anymore. But the still basic concepts of like, what is Bitcoin? What is blockchain? How does this actually work? And there are some diagrams that we've updated since then. So it's a phenomenal, like, easy read book. That you can give out to your friends and family.
My mom's birthday's coming up. That's what I'm thinking.
Exactly. Available where all books are sold.
I'll have a link in the episode description for this
Excellent. And we have a... This is my fault. We have it translated into Spanish. I just haven't released it yet.
Oh, okay.
But there is a Spanish version coming out.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. And I constantly keep on saying to my co-author, we got very busy. We need to update it a little bit. But the basic concepts are all there. Like if you're looking for deeper, what I think it is it's a good entry point. And then you can then jump into like Chris Dixon's book and go much deeper into those. But this will like just help you understand.
It'll build your foundation.
Yes, the foundation. We use a lot of analogies that people, the average person will see. The great thing is my mom, I gave her a copy of the book. She read it. She went and she bought Bitcoin the next day, which is phenomenal.
That's awesome.
And then a few months later.
Wait, when was this?
So this is 2020. So it was good. And like she was like, I don't know what to do. So she ended up using Coinbase, which worked out to her advantage. Because at the other time, and this is my own fault, I had been using Voyager personally because I was introduced to them early on. And so I got lazy. And so I was like, oh, well, this other company I use and I know better is Voyager. 2020, they were fine. And what worked out to her advantage and to our relationship advantage was that her bank kept on blocking Voyager. So she couldn't use Voyager. She could only use Coinbase. Fast forward 2 years later, Voyager collapses. I lost some money in there, but I was prepared because I've been testing out a lot of different systems of like my own personal wallets and like and centralized systems. And so I was like prepared for that. She wasn't. And so I was like, the company collapsed. I've lost a bit of money. I'm getting some of that back finally, but like had she lost money, I think I could have forgiven myself.
Yeah.
But I then like pushed her to buy something and then like encouraged her to use this platform that felt secure, but then wasn't. And then like, oh, I'm so sorry, mom. But fortunately it didn't. She bought some on Coinbase. She loved it. She ended up selling it like at a peak. And so she and my dad like, took a vacation for that. But
that's
it was
the thing most people struggle with is actually selling it.
It was. Well, again, fortunately
take the profit, please.
Exactly. She and my dad kind of get... They got bored and they're like, we don't understand this really, but we made some money. We're happy. We'll sell it. And then, and then we'll do a vacation. Like, so they had like the best scenario out of all of this.
That's not the normal path.
No, not the normal path at all.
Well, Yuri, is there anything else that you want to point people towards? Or is there anything, any places that people can go if they want to learn more about you? Is that podcast still around?
So the podcast is no longer on. It was called The Coin Chat. It may still be around. It may not. I think I took it all down. The book is called Be Left Behind, Discover Bitcoin and Blockchain Before Your Grandmother Beats You to It. Available wherever books are sold. You learn more about me. I have a personal website, yuricataldo.com. I'm also a partner at Athenian Capital, which is athenian.capital. We do a little bit of blockchain investing, but we're across the board. We're still, we do early stage, pre-seed seed investing mm-hmm. in a lot of different areas.
Web3, I think, was one of those too.
Right? Yeah. Web3 is a little more on the DeFi side of it. But we're kind of, we're a general, more of a generalist kind of fund in that sense.
Well, it sounds like I need to let you get out to the event so you can start mixing some elbows there. There's a few people doing pitches that you might want to sit in on.
Oh, excellent. That's exciting. Yeah. I love hearing about, particularly over the years, of how pitches have changed, people's focuses have changed. And now you can really see, especially in Web3, how people are solving problems and not like, I have a solution that's a technology solution and I'm in searching for a problem.
Right.
So it's great to hear the other way around, and I'm watching that more and more and more, which is, I think it's also a testament of how the blockchain industry is maturing. Regulation is now, I've at a few other conferences I've been to, there's a lot more talk about regulation because we realize that what's stifling a lot of advances is the government regulation and how they look at things. And so there's a lot more of that happening. So it's an exciting space to be a part of, and there's a lot more to go.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time, Yuri. We'll let you get out then.
Awesome. Thank you so much. My pleasure.
The cover art for this podcast was custom designed for us by the amazing people at Epic Made. Epic Made is a digital art and animation studio that actually understands the magic behind powerful creative assets for gaming, entertainment, and tech. So visit epicmade.com to get expert creative help for campaigns, commercials, socials, and more. That's epic-made.com. DSpark is the leading user research platform for Web3. Companies can easily get feedback from any type of user, helping them build better products and improve their marketing. If you're interested in giving feedback, get paid USDC to share your opinions and improve Web3. Visit DSpark.io today. That's DESPARK.io. Bola allows you to create, tokenize, and finance invoices and manage all of your on-chain accounts. With TCS Blockchain, they recently went live with their groundbreaking solution that uses blockchain to settle freight invoices 90% cheaper and faster than traditional means. Thank you for helping make this show possible, Bola. Go to bolanetwork.com and tcsblockchain.com to learn more and join the waitlist. Numbers Protocol harnesses blockchain technology to enhance authenticity and traceability of digital content globally, with operational bases in London, LA, Dubai, and Taiwan. Recognized as the best in Web3 at the 2023 SXSW Awards and supported by Google and NVIDIA, Numbers Protocol offers the Capture, an all-in-one suite for content verification, copyright protection, and monetization. This technology has proven pivotal in projects like the archival of the 2020 U.S. presidential election and supports artists and businesses in ensuring the integrity and security of digital media. Jotto is a cutting-edge platform that amplifies the customer voice by making it simple for organizations to gather feedback through video, audio, and text. Using powerful AI, Jotto analyzes this feedback in real time to deliver actionable insights that help organizations understand their audience better. Whether it's governments, businesses, or events, Jotto enables a deeper connection by ensuring every voice is heard and valued. It's an essential tool for anyone looking to turn raw feedback into strategic actions and drive meaningful engagement. So once again, thank you to our sponsors for helping make the show possible, and thank you everybody for listening. The views and opinions expressed on this program are their own and do not necessarily reflect the official policies or positions of any affiliated entities. The information shared in this podcast is for general informational purposes only and should not be construed as financial, legal, or professional advice. Always conduct your own research and consult with a qualified professional before making any decisions based on the content of this podcast. We appreciate your understanding and hope you enjoy the insights and expertise shared in today's episode.
Turn it off, we have the ending. I do have another question that I wanted to know if you could real quickly address. You talked about in the clinical trials the monetary problems, right, and how expensive it is to get all that stuff done. I wondered if you could just say something about another way that the blockchain could impact that, and that's underrepresented groups. Mm-hmm. So a lot of clinical trials, and the best example that I know of is that a lot of cancer drugs are not tested for children, but they have to be used for children because there aren't other applications or things available. So I just wondered if you could talk about that underrepresented.
Sure, of course. This is another great way that AI is being involved in things, and this is what a lot of companies are using of like the biases. So in this particular company, again, I'm going to keep talking about this particular company that's doing it because it's just so different from everything else. You're right. The average clinical study is, so people are handpicked for the best of, and again, although a lot of it is like white males, just because that's, you know, a lot of things in our world are designed for the average white male.
We have the most data on that, probably.
Yes, right? We have the most amounts of data, also because researchers choose to do that way, because a lot of researchers are white males. Right. I mean, there's a lot of like bias behind, like bias of bias of bias that leads into this. So an organization like this company, what was it called again? Care.Trials. Yeah. Is that what it was, Care Trials? Yes. Solve.care. Oh my gosh. Yeah, Solve.care. companies like this now, it's a different type of way to approach it because, first off, it's an opt-in. Nobody wants to think that they are being tested on. And so like, for example, cancer drugs being used on children, because they weren't fully done at a research level, you're essentially a test subject just to see how this works. And we're going to guess based on these averages of these white males who are, you know, certain types of heights, weights, builds, and then we're going to mathematically kind of build that down. What an organization like this that's doing that allows for individuals to opt in, they get to decide how their data is used and what types of data and the types of individuals. And so this organization is working with people and organizations from around the world to explain to them what these trials could be, what they're going to do, and also the benefit. And with that, they get a more diverse sets of individuals who are willing to hone in and give their health data over. And so what it's allowing researchers to do with this organization is to pinpoint, again, different types of diverse groups for whom these cancer drugs will be a benefit for. So it's not just, again, the average statistical white male. It's like different individuals. It's more of like pinpointing a sniper versus like a scattershot shotgun type of thing. And again, the individuals who are opting in understand what their data is being used for. They agree to all this up front and they understand the risks involved, if there are any, and then what things are being used for, and they get to pick and choose which trials, versus the other way around of it's data mining health records. And so right now, clinical trials, there are companies who make lots of money this way where they'll find your health records and then they pitch at you that you should be part of this trial because you are statistically significant to their research. Versus, again, the diversity of like, maybe this drug that's not so great for the average white male will be phenomenal for, you know, children in a particular region or a typical demographic. And so now with personalized medicine, which is really coming about because of AI and the best parts of blockchain, which is like, you know, trust, security, privacy, everybody cares about that too. Nobody wants the
accounting.
Yeah. Like nobody really wants their healthcare records to be used against them or to be used to profit without your knowledge. So these companies coming up are utilizing this. And so it's like a crowdsource effort, which when you start crowdsourcing things, that's why a lot of open source projects can get off the ground faster and are better long term because it's not just a small group of individuals.
Awesome. Thank you.
Sure.